Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you that views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. We welcome your calls from all across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us Dr. Peter Hammond from Africa. He's a missionary there, and he's going to be here in the States for just a brief period of time, and he's going to be with us this evening. Peter, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Good evening, Dr. Sam.
Well, let's talk a little bit about, of course, what's going on over in Africa. You were actually born in Rhodesia, brought up in South Africa?
Actually, yes, the other way around. I was born in South Africa, brought up in Rhodesia, and it's been my great privilege to live in Africa all my life.
All right. Well, of course, it is a beautiful, beautiful place, but it's plagued with problems today. So let's just go by country. Well, what's going on in South Africa today since the United States toppled the apartheid regime there and brought the Marxist government to power?
Well, Dr. Sand, it's been most distressing, actually, because while one can only rejoice that peace arrived in South Africa and sanctions were lifted and we could start to play international sports games and South Africa could take part in the Olympics, you know, those were some of the positives. But the negatives are crime has skyrocketed in the country. And Nelson Mandela had the prisons opened and over 100,000 people, criminals including murderers and rapists, were released onto the streets. And officially 94% recidivism rate, that's mean 94% of the convicts released immediately went back to the crimes they were imprisoned for. Not only that, but they abolished the death penalty for murder. Now we have well over 25,000 people a year being murdered in South Africa, which means since Mandela became president, over 500,000 South Africans have been murdered officially. And in fact, Interpol thinks it's probably more like 500,000. They think the South African official murder rate is understated by at least by half. Not only that, but Mandela legalized abortion. The killing of preborn babies is now legal in South Africa, whereas it never was before. So over 300,000 babies have been legally killed in South Africa since Mandela legalized abortion in 1997. In addition to that, pornography has been legalized, which, as you know, was never allowed before. Not only that, but homosexuality is now being promoted, whereas before it was a crime. The schools, which used to begin days with prayer, Bible reading, and hymn singing, now do not. They are trying to kick that out. Of course, some brave principals and school boards are continuing to have Christian worship, but they are increasingly being clamped down on. The government, the ANC government in South Africa of Mandela and Mbeki, are trying to push a humanistic interfaith worship in our school. They're promoting Islam, they're promoting humanism, occultism, but Christianity is definitely being penalized and pushed out. And even they're trying to harass Christian schools and homeschoolers and force them to adopt the government's secular curriculum. So the picture in South Africa is of tremendous amounts of crime and violence and a paganization which didn't exist before.
Well, now, of course, what about the employment for blacks? When I was there, why, the unemployment was fairly low. Everybody had a job. You know, there was certainly a stratified society. There were some very wealthy blacks. There were poor blacks. But what's happening to the unemployment since the United States brought freedom to South Africa?
Oh, my. The
I say that with a certain amount of bitterness there.
Yes, the economy has depleted tremendously. In fact, our opposition party in South Africa, the Democratic Party, which is hardly Christian, but they have calculated that the ANC has cost the South African people 4 million jobs. So instead of providing more jobs, there's been a net loss of 4 million jobs since Mandela became the president in South Africa in 1994. So, I mean, you can just imagine the country that's only got 42 million total population, to lose 4 million jobs is catastrophic. And just to give you another way of looking at it, when I was growing up, the South African rand was stronger than the American dollar. When Mandela was released from prison, after several years of sanctions in South Africa, the American dollar was two times as strong as the rand. So it cost 2 rand to buy $1. Today, it's more like 7 or 8 rand to the dollar. So the South African rand has lost a tremendous amount of its value, and unemployment is colossal in the country, and crime is sky high.
Well, I've heard it's something like among the black population, 40%. Is that what high or low?
That's it. It's approximately 40-42% of the black population would be unemployed officially. So it could even be worse.
What about the white population?
The white population, I'm not as sure about. It's probably quite high. There's no specific statistics. I do know that because of affirmative action, which is just racism, the white population has been dispersed worldwide. Many, having lost the jobs in South Africa, have gone to New Zealand, where South Africans are 10% of the population, to London, 800,000 South Africans just in Greater London alone, and there's South Africans all over America and Canada and elsewhere. So plainly, a lot of white South Africans have left, probably 3.5 million white South Africans, which leaves probably 3 million in South Africa. And of them, many are unemployed, but have become entrepreneurs and work from home and computer and new businesses and that sort of thing. So we've got a lot of innovation amongst many of the white population, but the vast amount lost their jobs, whereas most might have been employed in some kind of state or other agency. They, of course, have had to go more and more in the private sector, and even there they've been pushed out by affirmative action. And so what you've got now in South Africa is many parents, their children have gone overseas to find jobs, and families are split.
You've lost almost half the white population of South Africa.
At least, yes.
Well, now, of course, what about the incidence of AIDS and HIV disease in the population there? What are we talking about in the general population?
I saw official statistics a while ago, and I think that they were saying that 32% of the total population of South Africa had AIDS, 32% total, and that was highest in KwaZulu-Natal and in Gauteng, around Joburg, Pretoria, the PWV area, the Witwatersrand, where the mines are. So very, very high incidence. In some parts of the country, it's in the 60%. But overall, we're talking about 32% of South Africa has AIDS. And as you know, the president of South Africa at the moment, Mandela's handpicked successor, Thabo Mbeki, he doesn't believe AIDS really exists and doesn't think AIDS and HIV are connected at all. He thinks poverty is the main cause of AIDS.
Well, of course, he was also on the initially on the board of directors of Gorbachev's State of the World Forum, and they were, of course, dedicated to population control. And then, of course, he moved to South Africa and became the president there. It's almost as if somebody had picked him, because he wasn't even living in Africa for many years, was he?
No, the whole of the 60s, 70s, and 80s, for over 30 years, he lived in London was his home.
Right, and so suddenly, where did he get his constituency to elect him to replace Nelson Mandela? It's almost as if he'd been handpicked by somebody, but certainly not by the South African people.
No, I mean, he was Mandela's handpicked successor, and being the head of the ANC just meant an automatic election, because presidents in South Africa don't get elected by popular vote. The president is chosen by the ruling party.
And then, of course, don't they have some sort of an election there to verify? I remember when Nelson Mandela was elected, they printed up 80 million votes for 40 million voters, and there was a lot of irregularity in that election, wasn't there?
Oh, tremendous irregularities. In fact, the vast majority of the votes were never counted, because they were taking so long after the first day of the counting. Everyone said, you know, it's going to be the next election by the time and they actually extrapolated, it wasn't just a joke, before the votes are all counted. There was so much inefficiency and confusion and chaos that in the end, they took what they had counted and they extrapolated.
But of course,
as you know, it is not reliable.
But of course, wasn't Nelson Mandela the man who had been handpicked by the American State Department to rule South Africa?
Yes, well, he was. I mean, for well over a decade, he had been promoted in that way. So it looked like a script that was written overseas, and the local people had no say in the matter. And the fact that they never even counted all the votes, and there were so many things that were major irregularities. There was intimidation. There were some bombings. There was a lot of violence that happened beforehand. And then you found a whole massive containers filled with ballots that hadn't been counted, just abandoned. And there was, before the election, all the different things needed for security and so on were stolen. And there was just vast amounts of irregularity. So many people did not believe that the ANC really won that election, but that it was stolen. It was handed to them. But the invitations to come to Mandela's enthronement as the new president had been printed long before the elections began, and had been sent out, and all the people from Gaddafi and Yasser Arafat and Castro and of course your Hillary Clinton, they were all invited long before the first vote was cast, let alone counted.
Well, isn't democracy wonderful?
Yes, indeed.
Well, let's get off into, of course, the tragedy of Rhodesia. And I don't think most Americans understand how we picked the leader there, because the people had actually voted for a different leader, and we didn't like him, so we wanted to bring in the communist Mugabe. Well, could you tell the story of how Mugabe got to be the leader of Rhodesia?
Yes, well, you know, Rhodesia was really such an ideal country. It had the lowest crime rate in the world, and it was decreasing. It had the lowest unemployment in the world. Rhodesia was really a paradise to live in. I remember being brought up there where you didn't even take the keys out the car, and there was no burglar bars, doors were left wide open, even through the night. It was a country that was very free of crime. It was a paradise in so many ways. But this Robert Mugabe was adopted by the Chinese, and he went in the 60s and was trained under Mao Zedong in China. And he got massive amounts of support from Red China, and he was a terrorist. He of course, had missionaries such as the Elam Mission Station, missionaries and their children murdered on his own orders. He was behind the burning of churches with congregations in it, massacres of all kinds, and, you know, people having their limbs hacked off. You've seen the pictures. You know what we're talking about. But incredibly, even with some of the most vicious terrorism going on in the world, he was getting funded by the World Council of Churches, and the United Nations was funding him as well. So next thing we know, Henry Kissinger is pushing Rhodesia to hand over to a British governor who, as you know, handed over Rhodesia to this Marxist thug Mugabe.
But I thought
a travesty of an election.
But I thought the people voted in Bush Mhezeweyo, who was a moderate black man.
Correct. Rhodesia did have one man, one vote, multiracial elections, as was required. And under the Kissinger peace plan, Rhodesia went for this internal settlement, had all the black people voted, and they elected this black leader, a moderate black man, a church leader, Bishop Abel Muzorewa. And so Rhodesia became Zimbabwe Rhodesia, and it's had a one-man, one-vote, majority-rule country with a black president. But that was not good enough, because he wasn't a communist. And so the Rhodesians were pressured and bullied into having another election within a year when they had to... literally, the elected president had to resign and hand over to a British governor. How about that? And the British governor changed all the rules, so that at the end of it, the moderate black leader who had been elected by the vast majority of the people of Rhodesia was ousted, and in comes this unelected Marxist mass murderer, Robert Mugabe, and he's placed in with the United Nations, the Organization of African Unity, the British Commonwealth, the U.S. State Department, cheering that, you know, this is the will of the people. And it wasn't the will of the people. It was a foisted New World Order solution pushed on Zimbabwe Rhodesia, and we lost our freedom.
And now, of course, was this the United States or was this the United Nations who engineered this whole communist takeover of the country against the will of the people?
Well, we have to give the credit to several agencies working in collusion. The British Foreign Office and the American State Department definitely were working hand in glove together, and so it was Lord Carrington of England, and it was Andrew Young of the US under Jimmy Carter who did the final engineering, and they worked very closely together on this despicable betrayal of Rhodesia. And of course this was very much the will of the World Council Church of the United Nations, but I have to say that the British Foreign Office and the American State Department take primary blame for betraying Rhodesia. It was well put by Ian Smith. We were never beaten by our enemies. We were betrayed by our friends.
Well, of course, it's well known that, you know, if you have America as an enemy, you may survive, but if you have America as a friend, you know you'll be betrayed.
In fact, we've heard it put that if America is your, if you're the enemy of America, you may be bought, but if you're America's friend, you'll certainly be sold.
Well, let's get into what's going on there today. We brought together this brutal Marxist dictator into Rhodesia. And where is Rhodesia today? My understanding is it's bankrupt. 6 million people are facing starvation. There's chaos. There's murder. The courts are corrupt. Mugabe is taking the land and giving it to his cronies and his sister. And, of course, the blacks there are really facing starvation. Now, these are people who always had jobs before. And, of course, now they have absolutely nothing and no hope. What's your take on what's going on in Rhodesia today?
Dr. Stan, you've summed it up very well. The crisis in Zimbabwe is absolutely severe. The people are dying of starvation in a man-made famine, and it's orchestrated by the communist government of Robert Mugabe. Thousands of productive farms have been seized by government-organized mobs. Vast herds of cattle and wildlife have been slaughtered. The crops and stores have been burned. Farmhouses have been looted. Over 5,000 farmhouses have been looted. Many people have been beaten or murdered. So Zimbabwe had one of the most productive agricultural economies in Africa, but it's been systematically destroyed. Remember, these farms are run overwhelmingly by white farmers, commercial farmers. Not only did these farms feed the entire nation, but they also exported food. They provided the highest percentage of foreign exchange earnings for the country. The commercial farms were also the largest employers of labor in the country. They provided homes for up to 4 million farm workers and their dependents. But the president of Zimbabwe, the dictator, Robert Mugabe, he needed a scapegoat for his failed socialism. So he played the race card. He declared, farmers are the enemies of the state. Those farmers who resist will die. We have set the rule. The revolution is yet to be concluded. And what he said he was doing was he was following the example of Joseph Stalin, who launched his de-kulakization campaign in the 1930s in Russia to exterminate the kulaks as a class. The kulaks were the farmers of the Ukraine, and you'd remember whole farms were razed to the ground, villages destroyed, peasants massacred. 6 million people died in the man-made famine under Stalin, but communist control was entrenched. And that's what's going on in Zimbabwe today. It's a repeat of Stalin's de-kulakization campaign of the 30s in Russia. What Mugabe is doing is blatant racism. All white farmers are having their farms taken from them by force. They're murdering farmers, they are murdering and assaulting farm laborers, black farm laborers who work for them, and they are just trashing, looting, and destroying it. It's not taking over the farms to continue the production, it's looting and destroying them, right down to the equipment, burning the barns, destroying the cattle dips, blowing up wells. It's so destructive. It's a national suicide.
Well, of course, now what is being done by the adjacent countries to put a stop to it, or by the United Nations? What are they doing? After all, when Ian Smith turned power over, to Mugabe, it was with the promise of Henry Kissinger that we would always be there to enforce peace and maintain a just government. What is the United States government, which gave its solemn word to protect the Rhodesian people, doing today?
Well, indeed, Dr. Stan, I remember that the American government did guarantee that they would guarantee the rule of law, the safety and security of the people, especially the farms, and the American State Department has not been good on their word. They have not backed up what they promised. So the people of Rhodesia did what the American government wanted, but they have not followed their side of the bargain.
All right. Well, we're going to be back here in just a few moments with Peter Hammond. But right now we're going to have to take a little break. And just remember that a government that will betray its friends will betray eventually its own people. Mm-hmm. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Peter Hammond, and we're talking about what's going on in Rhodesia today. And it really sounds like, of course, there's terrible chaos and death. And do we have any idea how many people have actually starved, over there? Is the starvation really there, or is it simply looming in the near future?
No, people are dying of starvation already, Dr. Stan, definitely. But it's hard to state because, as you know, it's such an oppressive Marxist regime. They have expelled all foreign journalists. There are no foreign journalists allowed in the country. And in fact, many of the local journalists have been beaten up and killed. The only independent radio station in Zimbabwe got blown up, with the army and police standing by laughing. The only independent daily newspaper in the country, the Daily News, got blown up as well, with army and police standing by laughing on the other side of the road as well. And we've had editors of newspapers, we're talking about Zimbabwean newspapers, attacked, beaten up, arrested by military police, tortured with electrocution and cattle prods. So it's very hard to get facts out of Zimbabwe, as you can imagine. There's just such total oppression. Even the courts are being intimidated. On numerous occasions, the courts in Zimbabwe, which of course were even set up by Mugabe, have found against the government's position and have ordered the government to back down on what they're doing and said this is unconstitutional and so on. And Mugabe's threatened the lives of his Supreme Court justices. We've had Supreme Court justices assaulted, beaten up in their chambers, in court, by a youth militia and mobs of Mugabe. And many of them have, of course, resigned. And he has put some virtually illiterate propagandists into position as judges in Zimbabwe to fill the roles of those who have fled the intimidation. So what you're talking about in Zimbabwe is anarchy. It's state-sponsored anarchy. It's state-sponsored terrorism. It's savagery. It's racism. It's vicious. In fact, Mugabe has said, we have degrees in violence. I studied in Red China. I know how to do violence. Some of you have degrees in agriculture and engineering. I have a degree in violence. I will be a black Hitler tenfold. What Hitler did to the Jews, I'll do 10 times worse to you whites.
And, of course, many of the whites have just picked up and left the country and left everything behind?
Oh, yes, most have. In fact, when I lived in Zimbabwe, there were 300,000 whites. Today, there's probably not even 40,000 whites in the whole country. And many of them might be out of the country at the moment on holiday, so-called. It's just terrible. Almost the only whites left in the country at this moment are the old people, the pensioners. Anyone who can has fled.
Well, now, of course, what about getting food into the country to help the people so they don't starve? Hasn't there been any help? What's the United Nations doing?
Well, apparently, I don't know what the United Nations is doing. It's certainly nothing useful because they seem to be backing this man. In fact, the United Nations invited Mugabe to be a plenary speaker at last year's summit on sustainable development. And not only was he a plenary speaker at the summit of sustainable development by the UN, but he was applauded. I mean, can you imagine a man who is having his farms destroyed, who is having game reserves invaded, who is having entire forest reserves burned to the ground, a man who should be speaking on sustainable destruction, and the UN invites him to speak on sustainable development and applauds him?
I remember when Idi Amin, of course, used to give speeches, and he would always get applauded as well. I mean, one of the most brutal murderers of all of Africa. It seems that they seem to have more respect for strong people than humanitarian leaders.
It would seem so. In fact, the words of Winston Churchill come to mind. He spoke this about the communists.
You're going to have to hold that for just a moment. We'll be back in just a moment when our... Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Dr. Peter Hammond. We're talking about what's going on in Africa. We're talking about the tragedy of Rhodesia. You're not reading about it in your newspapers, but people are being slaughtered there. Most of the whites have fled. People are frankly starving to death, and very little coverage in the controlled media in America. And you were talking about Winston Churchill as we were discussing this and trying to put this insanity that's taking place in Zimbabwe into perspective. What were you about to say?
Yes, Dr. Stan, Winston Churchill said about the communists, there's nothing they respect more than strength. There's nothing they despise more than weakness. And that is the point. The American government has in the past been seen as completely weak, and for this reason, they have despised America. And There's only one language that Marxists and tyrants understand, and that's strength, military strength.
Well, of course, you know, there is really a communist regime in South Africa, in Southwest Africa, in Angola, in Rhodesia. All of them, of course, are backed by the American government. But the average American has no realization of this. They're so totally oblivious of what's going on over there halfway around the world.
Indeed. I've been quite surprised that your media loses interest in a country after it's been given over to the Marxists. You know, you just think of the massive interest in American media in Vietnam until America pulled out. And then what? Well, they didn't seem to want to cover the vast massacres of hundreds of thousands of people and the people being imprisoned in concentration camps and all the other things that happened after the betrayal of South Vietnam. Similarly with Rhodesia, there was tremendous interest in Rhodesia beforehand, and if security forces shot a terrorist, they would make a big scene about this. But the moment Rhodesia was betrayed into the hands of communist Zimbabwe, it seemed that the government there could kill hundreds of thousands of its own people without any news coverage of it over this side. It seems that the people who helped to bring about the tyrants in these positions don't want to report what happens afterwards.
For whatever reason that would be. Well, is there anything else we should cover with Rhodesia, or should we perhaps go to what's going on in Nigeria today?
Well, just before we go to Nigeria, just to remember that the people in Zimbabwe are resisting. There are Christians there. We are smuggling in food to help the people who are starving because the government of Sudan, the government of Zimbabwe, does not allow any food to be brought in and distributed amongst the people. It's got to be given to the government, and only the ruling party, the ZANU-PF Communist Party, are the only ones who are allowed to distribute food aid. So you know what they mean. It means communist members get food, and the Christians are to be starved to death. So we have to smuggle in not only Christian literature, but we have to smuggle in food into Zimbabwe. But we are doing that, and we are helping with leadership training and various underground work to assist the church in Zimbabwe. So be sure there is resistance in Zimbabwe, and there's some tremendous things going on that we can't talk about. But do pray for our teams. We have a team that's just been in Zimbabwe very recently, and I'm looking forward to getting an update from them as well.
Well, let's tell our listeners up there in the Great Northwest, listening to the program and across America, how they can get in touch with your ministry. And let me recommend Frontline Ministry. We, our family supports it because we believe in Peter Hammond and what he's doing. How can people get in touch with you, get to your website, get your regular letter, which we incidentally are getting by email? So why don't you give your telephone number, your website, and how people can get in touch with your ministry?
Thank you so much, Dr. Stanley. Well, Frontline Fellowship really wants to provide ammunition, spiritual ammunition, information to folks as to what's going on in Africa, what's going on in the persecuted church, and expose the reality of what communism and Islam really do. So our website is www.frontline.org.za. So that's FRONTLINE, frontline.org.za. And that's our website. We've got lots of articles, pictures, the whole photo albums on Zimbabwe and South Africa and Sudan and Nigeria. So you can look there and see a lot of what we're talking about, many articles and resources, books we've produced, videos and other things. And you can also phone an 800 number where they will send to you some free reports on what's going on. Now, we don't send out newsletters speaking about so much what we've done and asking for funds. We don't do that. We're a faith mission. What we're doing is setting up documentation, what's going on in the country. So if you phone 1-888-918-4100 and ask for some of the frontline newsletters on Zimbabwe, Zambia, Nigeria, South Africa, they'll be sent to you free. So that's 1-888-918-4100.
All right, fine. And so we'll try to get that out again later. Or if you didn't get it, you can call our producer, and I'm sure Jeannie has that number there. But terrible, terrible things are happening. We bear a responsibility because, of course, our government was primarily responsible in bringing communism to South Africa, to Rhodesia, to Southwest Africa, to Angola, and of course we'll be talking very, very shortly about what's going on in Nigeria. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Dr. Peter Hammond, and we're talking about what's already going on in Africa. And Peter is on the front lines of this, travels out there, into, of course, into the Sudan on a regular basis. And but you've recently been in Nigeria, and of course, we've gotten a little bit of information on Nigeria, but not that much. And yet, of course, this is one of the great tragedies of modern times as well, isn't it?
Well, yes, Nigeria is a real country of contrast, a country of conflict. Nigeria, similar to Sudan, has got a Muslim north and a Christian south, but unlike Sudan, in Nigeria, it's the Christians who are the majority. So while Sudan's the largest country in Africa in terms of size, Nigeria's the largest nation in terms of population. There's 120 million people in 490 ethnic groups. But Nigeria's got more Muslims and more Christians than any other country in Africa. It's a huge country. And Christians are being severely persecuted in Nigeria's northern states. The northern states, 12 northern states of Nigeria, have declared Sharia law, Islamic law. And literally hundreds of churches have been destroyed. And literally thousands of Christians have been murdered in Nigeria just in the last couple of years.
But isn't that, of course, directly related to our good friends, the Saudis, who are pushing their radical form of Islam, not only, of course, in throughout the Middle East and with Al-Qaeda, but also, of course, in Nigeria?
Indeed, yes. The Saudi Arabians seem to be the number one financiers and sponsors of the radical Islamic agenda in Nigeria. There are mosques, hundreds of mosques springing up all over the country, madrasas and Islamic schools being funded by Saudi Arabia. And there's a tremendous amount of radicalism, the kind of Islam being preached in Nigeria. And I've got some of these quotes here that I brought back from mainstream Islam. And these are publications printed with Saudi Arabian money. Priests in their churches should, of course, be killed without any exception. They should not leave a church building standing in any Muslim area. All Christian activities, no matter what the secular expression, should be stopped. All Christian universities, hospitals, orphanages, schools should be taken over. Muslim organizations must set up intelligence centers to monitor Christian activities. No Christian literature may be distributed in Muslim areas. And it carries on and on. It speaks about eradicating all Christian systems to strive for only Arabic to be used. Here's another quote. All Christians must be brought out into public and be shot. These are the kind of things being published in radical Islamic publications funded by Saudi Arabia in Nigeria.
And then, of course, I remember our president saying, you're either with us or against it, you're with the terrorists or with us, and the Saudi Arabians are the force behind the terrorists, and we do absolutely nothing about that, other than, of course, to help them at every turn. So then, of course, what's happening in the southern part of Nigeria? Is it that fairly tranquil, or is it simply in the northern area where they're slaughtering the Christians?
Well, no, there's a lot of tension in the southern areas because the Muslims are trying to take over. In fact, do you know that there was, over the last 43 years that Nigeria has been independent, since Britain left in 1960, they have been under Muslim military dictators for 38 of those years. So until just a few years ago, Nigeria was only under Islamic military dictators. They've had six revolutions, six violent changes of government in Nigeria, and they had, of course, a vicious civil war between the Muslims and Christians in the 1960s, the Biafran Civil War, when you'd remember a few million people, mostly Christians, died at the hands of the Muslims. And I'm sorry to say, the American government, along with Red China and the Soviet Union, supported the Muslim dictatorship in their war against the Christians, even with military aid during that horrific Biafran Civil War. But right now, there is a nominal Christian president, the Muslim candidate, lost in the only free election the country's ever had, which was just now, when I was there. Just a few months ago, they had their first free elections ever, and the Christian candidate won and the Muslim candidate lost. So we're very glad for that. And I must say that there is tremendous church growth throughout Nigeria. Everywhere I went, churches are growing and being built up. But you can imagine the hostility of the Muslims, because they want Nigeria to be an Islamic country. It's an oil-rich country, and it's the most strategic country in the whole of West Africa, maybe the whole of North Africa, because it's the most populous country. And the Muslims want Nigeria desperately. And yet the church is winning over not just the middle-of-the-road people, but they're winning over Muslims. Muslims are coming to Christ in Nigeria. And so the lash out and the reaction from the Muslims is incredibly violent, because they can't seem to compete with the Christians in terms of arguments. So what they do is they react violently.
And of course, you had commented on another program about a motion picture that's available in the United States. It's called, and of course, it's a Hollywood production with Bruce Willis, but Tears in the Sun. Is that a fair, even though I know it's a Hollywood production, is that a pretty good representation of what's going on there, the violence, the horror?
Yes, Dr. Stan, it really is. I was quite astounded. I saw the film Tears of the Sun on a plane 2 days after leaving Nigeria, and I was quite astounded at its accuracy, because I'd just come from the very area in the eastern part of Nigeria where the film was set, and I thought they had it all accurate, what they were, the kind of atrocities committed by the Muslims, the whole scenario, the anti-Christian persecution of a mission station there. I do recommend anyone who's got a strong stomach and can handle a very realistic, brutal but very accurate picture of what Islam is doing in a country such as Nigeria and Africa, see Tears of the Sun by Bruce Willis. It'll open your eyes to the reality.
Well, I think that we have so many Americans who think that nothing like that could ever happen here. Certainly nothing bad is ever going to happen to Christians. God would never allow that. And I think that, of course, they're living in a make-believe world. We live in a world of violence where Christianity is under attack at every turn. And I believe, of course, men and women become accomplices to the evils they fail to oppose. So what needs to be done as far as Nigeria is concerned?
I would say three things, three I's. We need to be informed, we need to be interceding, and we need to be involved. Being informed, of course, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. We need to support independent radio programs such as this one. We need to tune in, we need to support it. Independent newsletters that can give people other sides, such as our own. Get on email updates, check out websites, look at the alternative media, because I'm afraid we're not getting the facts from the mainstream media. Slime, Newspeak, Useless News and World Report, and the Clinton News Network, they are not giving us the whole story. We need to go to the alternative source. So being informed is the first thing, and then being interceding. We need to pray as individuals, as families, even at mealtimes, and in our churches. Put the persecuted church, put the African persecuted church on your prayer list, even at your home church. And then being involved. There's always something we can do, and I would say, one thing that I think is important is you as Americans have got tremendous privilege with your elected representatives. Do write to them, speak up, phone, send emails, because if your elected representatives and State Department and Senate Foreign Relations Committee, if they're hearing from enough citizens about concerns of these issues, they respond to pressure. I think it was well put by President Ronald Reagan. Politicians don't see the light until they felt the heat. And may I encourage you to put a little bit of heat on your elected representatives to do something to support the persecuted, not the persecutors.
All right, fine. Well, of course, great, great tragedy. Do we have any idea how many Christians have been slaughtered in Nigeria here in the last couple of years?
I do not, but I do know that it's in the tens of thousands without a doubt. I can say this much. We know that more Christians died on September 11th, 2001 in the one town of Jos than perished in the World Trade Center in New York on that same day's attack, because on the very day that the terrorists attacked New York and Washington, the Muslims poured out the streets of different towns across the north of Nigeria, including the town of Jos, where I just had evangelistic rallies and seminars, and so that's how I know about this. The people said, the Muslims were screaming, Allah Akbar, and they were just so excited over the great news of this wonderful victory of America and the deaths of so many Americans. And they went to celebrate it. They burnt down 100 churches and killed over 3,000 Christians that day in Jos. And they did this in Kaboko, Kano, and towns all over the north of Nigeria. It was absolutely horrific. And the Christians had to fight back just to save their lives. But this is the kind of radical anti-Americanism and anti-Christian violence that Christians have endured in Nigeria.
Well, you mentioned, of course, on another program that, of course, the Christians really had very little to fight with. I mean, they had clubs and machetes, and of course, the other side was armed. And what was this? Was on that occasion when this truck turned over and full of arms?
That was an incredible provision of the Lord. The Christians were being overwhelmed by the Muslims, who were well prepared, they were well armed, they had modern weaponry that had obviously been smuggled in, they'd been pre-planned, prepared for waiting for some event when they would spring this attack on the Christians, and when the world's media would not be reporting on it. So they were slaughtering Christians, but the Christians had nothing but clubs and baseball bats and a few spears and machetes. And then suddenly a massive semi-truck, an 18-wheeler, crashed in a Christian suburb, spilling thousands of AK-47 assault rifles, Kalashnikovs, on the road, and hundreds of thousands of rounds of ammunition. Well, the Christians just looked, praised God, saw it as his provision, took up the weapons, and the tide turned. They fought back with renewed vigor, and they chased the Muslims out of that whole town of Jos, and that was just one major turning point when they took the initiative and fought back, and Muslims were shocked and said, "We never thought the Christians would fight back. We've been attacking Christians all these years, and we've never seen them fight back like this before." And so an uneasy peace descended after that, but it wasn't because the government protected them. The government forces were staying in their barracks, and there no policemen or soldiers were seen during the whole violence. And only when the Christians had restored peace and protected their areas and chased these murderers out of their areas or killed them, only then did peace return.
And of course, the chances that would happen by just accident, the truck would overturn is pretty slim.
Indeed, there was no other vehicle involved in the accident. It was just like right in front of their eyes, and the Christians just, didn't even imagine. The truck, by the way, was coming from Niger. Niger's another country to the north, which is 99% Muslim, and they were no doubt resupplying the Muslim radicals in their massacres.
Well, of course, God does work in strange and unusual ways. Well, of course, so much of Africa is bound up in either this fight against communism or against the radical Muslims, and there looks like there's going to be very little peace. What's happening with Sudan? Now, we hear there's some sort of a peace accord there. What's that all about?
There is. Basically, what's happened, Dr. Stan, is as you know, the Christian South has fought very well, very tenaciously, and they have stopped the Muslim advance. In fact, not since 1996 have the Arabs managed to gain any ground. Their offensives have failed in all recent years. And since 1997, the SPLA has gained a tremendous amount of territory, something about the size of New Mexico that they've gained in southern Sudan by a lot of tremendous military offensives.
These are the Christians now.
That's correct. The overwhelming Christians in the south have liberated easily 85% of the south of Sudan from the government of Sudan. So there's areas like Equatoria, an entire province of western Equatoria that is free of all Arab troops and has been for over 5 years, and where the Christians have total control. So the Arabs had lost the initiative, and they had lost their offensives, and they had been reduced down to just aerial bombardments of the people, terror attacks from the air. So when America started bombing Afghanistan and then Iraq, the government of Sudan seemed to be eager to sit down at the negotiation table and work out the differences with the South. We don't trust this. We think they're just biding their time or afraid that America might have targeted them, and they want to look reasonable and peaceful. So at the moment, there's an uneasy ceasefire, and peace talks are going on in Sudan. And the government of Sudan, we think, is just rearming and waiting for a more opportune time when they can renew their attack. But that's the situation at the moment.
Well, now, what about the influence of the United Nations, in Africa? What are they doing to help maintain freedom and democracy?
Well, Dr. Stan, it doesn't look like the United Nations is doing anything to preserve democracy or to restore democracy in a way. All we see the United Nations doing is trying to promote abortions and support Muslim and Marxist dictators, persecutors of the church. It's been an extraordinary experience of mine. I remember when I was a youngster in Rhodesia, one of our favorite films at that time was The Man from U.N.C.L.E., the UN secret service agents working to keep the world safe for freedom. And so I thought the UN were the good guys, but other children in my school who were refugees from the Congo, the Belgian Congo. They said, no, the UN troops are the ones who looted our home and bombed our hospital. And I said, but the United Nations are the good guys. What about the man from Uncle? And they said, no, the UN is bad.
You were watching too much television.
Well, right back there in the 60s, I started to see a divergence from what was given to you as the reality on the screen with what was reality in real life. And since then, my missionary work in Angola, in Rwanda and Sudan has confirmed that the UN is not part of the solution. They're actually part of the problem. In fact, they're a major part of the problem. They have been preventing us from doing our missionary work in Angola. They've been forbidding Christians to fly to the Nubian Mountains to assist Christians in the Sudan. They helped disarm the Christians in Rwanda and then stood by and did nothing when the Christians were slaughtered by their own government. And so everywhere I can think of in Africa, the UN has done nothing to help the people and nothing to help the Christians, but only to help the persecutors of the church and the tyrants. The UN is very much an anti-freedom and anti-Christian organization, as far as we can tell from Africa.
And of course, the idea that they're anti-Christian, they've done everything they could, I know, in the Sudan, to block you from taking Bibles into the Christians, didn't they?
Indeed. I've had the UN tell me, if you take off with Bibles, we'll blow you out of the sky. That was the exact word.
Why were they so concerned about Bibles? If you'd been smuggling weapons or something, or do they feel that maybe the Bible is more powerful than the weapon?
Well, of course the Bible is more powerful than the
of course it is.
Weapons, and maybe they even recognize that. I've asked these UN officials that themselves, and they said, well, we're just enforcing the law of the government of Sudan, to which I say, nonsense. You fly beer and whiskey in your UN planes into Sudan, which is against the Sharia law of the government of Sudan, for your own staff members in Sudan. They say, oh, well, that's different. Well, of course it is. And they said, but, you know, the Bible's religious. And I said, well, so is the Quran, but your UN planes have flown Qurans into Sudan government towns, such as in Juba. Well, the government of Sudan asked us for that. So they're not consistent. And the United Nations is happily flying in masses of food aid to the government troops in the besieged garrison towns, thereby providing an efficient air arm to the persecutors of the church and prolonging the war. The vast majority of the UN's food that's meant to go to the starving is not going to the starving people of Sudan, as you know. It's going to the very government who's causing the famines. The government that's poisoning the wells, that's burning the crops, that's stealing looting the livestock, that government that's causing this man-made famine, they are the ones that the UN is delivering millions of tons of food aid to, and trusting the causes of the famine, the National Islamic Front government, to distribute the food aid in a free and fair way. And you know that that's not done. What happens is the food aid is only given to Muslims, to the Muslim government people, and they use it as a weapon to force the Christians to convert to Islam, or they are just starved.
Well, now, of course, one of the things, the government of Sudan didn't have a lot of money until the Chinese came in, and something called China's Petrol would raise, I think, about $5 billion on American equity markets. They raised it here in the United States. And then they went over and financed the Sudanese government that was killing the Christians. Why? That isn't a fair question to ask you, but it seems so out of character that America, that supposedly supports freedom and democracy and representative government and Christianity and brotherhood, you know, that we would allow the Chinese to come in and raise money in our equity markets and then fund a totalitarian government that's slaughtering Christians, that just doesn't seem quite right.
It is outrageous, Dr. Stan, and that is exactly what's happened. What we've seen is the China National Petroleum, Canadian Talisman, have provided the vast amount of funding for this, and of course most of the weapons that are purchased for this war are purchased from Red China. So Red China is making money both ways, from the oil and from the weapons, out of this war. Red China is a major player in this, and the oil companies have helped fuel the war.
Well, now, of course, what's happening to the oil in the Sudan? Will that be some of the profits will go to the people in the south, or how is this all going to work?
Well, definitely no profits are going to the people in the south. The people in the south, all that they get from the government of Sudan are aerial bombardments and shellings and artillery and rocket attacks. So there's been no government function in the South aside from blowing up bridges and bombing hospitals and schools, they're definitely not going to benefit from the oil revenue, except for the fact that the government's land can now afford more weapons of major destruction by buying more MiG fighter bomber jets and more Antonov bombers and more Hind helicopter gunships and more ordnance to throw our way. So certainly we don't expect anything good to come from the oil. At the moment, we are told in the whole of the Muslim Middle East, one out of every three barrels of oil goes to buy weapons. In Sudan, we are told that it's more like one out of every two barrels of oil goes to buy weapons.
And of course, what about the oil pipelines? Are the Christians in the South attacking those pipelines, or how is that working?
I do not believe they've done that just yet. I know that the Christians said that they would, but during the ceasefire, of course, you know what happens in ceasefires. The Muslims don't keep their side of ceasefires, but the Christians keep theirs. So there's been no attacks initiated from the South, even though there have been some bombings by the North, which they claim not to have any responsibility for. I don't know how you have aerial bombardments without the government taking responsibility. But no, there's been no attacks yet on oil pipelines, but I think one could expect that if the war resumes.
Well, now, of course, one more country, I think, which is of interest is Angola, which, of course, has been largely financed by Chevron Oil Company, keeping the communist government there in power. And for years, of course, they financed Fidel Castro's troops, so they eventually left. And now I understand there's some sort of a ceasefire. They're trying to get at least some stability over there. Aren't the majority of people Christians and against the communist government that we're backing?
Indeed. The overwhelming majority of the people of Angola are Christians as well. Tremendous amount of Baptists and Presbyterians there, and they completely loathe communism. They have resisted it. They've fought all these years since 1975, since Cuba, over 28 years ago, Cuba installed this unpopular Marxist dictatorship, the MPLA, the Marxist People's Liberation Army of Angola. The people of Angola have resisted this, and first with South African support, and UNITA, Jonas Savimbi's freedom fighters, fought incredibly bravely, very tenaciously. They liberated at least a third of the country, and in those areas, the people had full religious freedom. And I've been swimming into Angola since 1985, and smuggling in Bibles and having church services there and ministering to people. And we've been running leadership training courses throughout Angola, and we certainly appreciate the freedom we could experience in the UNITA, the Jonas Savimbi-controlled areas of Angola. But then, you know, the war was bad. There was something in a region of 300,000 people killed in the war, in something like 20-odd years of war. And then the UN came in 1991, and as South Africa left Southwest Africa, and this is all part of the peace handover plans, and then they had elections in 1992, and it was the most abominable abuse of the word elections ever seen. In the national capital of Luanda, 10,000 Ubumbundu people were slaughtered, killed by government troops in 3 days of elections. I mean, have you ever heard of elections like that? 10,000 people killed in 3 days of elections, including the vice president of UNITA, Jeremiah Chitunda, a man that I knew. And he was shot dead under the UN protection with his hands tied behind his back with wire.
You mean the United States, the United Nations was protecting this man?
Yes, that's right. And under the UN protection, he was murdered execution style, bullet to the head with his hands tied behind his back with wire, with UN troops all around. I mean, it was just wickedness that you couldn't imagine. So UNITA, of course, went back to the bush to fight. And the UN declared UNITA to be in breach of the agreement. Now, UNITA just lost 10,000 supporters and their vice president murdered, and in an abominable abuse of everything. And so the war continues. And what does the UN do? They put complete international sanctions, ring of steel, shoot on sight on free Christian Angola in the south. And our mission suffered under that too. We were the only ones still smuggling in things to UNITA. Not even a Red Cross could go. There was no Bibles or medicine allowed to go to the south, although the north was allowed to bomb us in the south. So Angola, here's the statistics. In 30 years of war, before the UN came in, there were a total of 300,000 people killed in the whole war, all sides. In the next 3 years of peace under the UN, 650,000 people were killed. So peace under the UN proved to be infinitely worse than war before them. The UN has this incredible knack of going into a bad situation and making it much, much worse.
Well, it's a pretty sad commentary. The tragedy is, Peter, that the average American has no idea what goes on in Africa. And with the blackout of the news that we have, you know, and of course all the people here, you know, think United Nations is so wonderful and UNICEF is so wonderful and we want the little kids out on Halloween getting money for UNICEF. And we never hear any of the atrocities that the United Nations commits, not only in Africa, but throughout the world. And without, of course, a free press, there is no possible way we as a nation can survive, as we've said recently, why increasingly the fourth estate in the United States is becoming a fifth column. Well, are you going to have to take off here, or will you be able to stay by the next hour?
I'm afraid that I should probably wrap up very soon, because we've got a very early morning start with seminars starting right early. So over here on the East Coast, we're at midnight, and I know I've got to be up and running at 6.
All right, fine. Well, we certainly appreciate your being with us. Now, will you be? When will you be heading back to Africa?
I'm still in the States for at least another week, and then, yes, I'll be back in Africa in time for our Reformation Day conferences and all of that at the end of the month.
All right, well, maybe we can get you on for one of our Saturday programs. Well, let's get your telephone number and website out one more time, and then we'll let you wrap it up.
Thank you, Dr. Stan. Yes, if anyone wants documentation, I know I've said a lot of things that some people may find incredible, but we've got documentation. I wrote the book Holocaust in Rwanda on the role of the UN and gun control and the massacres there, and there's the terrorism and persecution video, Understanding Islamic Jihad, Faith and Defiance Sudan. All of these are available on our website, www.frontline.org.za. So it's frontline, frontline.org.za. Or you can phone 1-888-918-4100, and they'll send you free copies of our newsletter reports, or you can find out how to get hold of books or videos there. So it's 1-888-918-4100 or www.frontline.org.za.
And let me encourage you, you know, this is a ministry that's well worthwhile supporting, and I would encourage you to do it. Peter, thank you so much for being with us. It's always a pleasure, and maybe we can get you on for a pre-recorded program sometime next week when you're not going to be, of course, having to get up at a terrible, terrible hour. God bless you. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Dr. Stan. God bless.
Bye-bye. All right, fine. Well, I hope our listeners have enjoyed our conversation with Peter Hammond. He's certainly one of my favorite guests. And if you've heard him before, you have a feeling that he's been there, he knows what's going on, and this is a tragic, tragic, tragic situation. Well, we had hoped that Peter would be with us for the second hour, but because it's so late back there and because he has to be up at such a very early hour, why, of course, we're going to have open lines the next hour, and you'll be able to call in. We'll try to come up with some ideas and some thoughts, but, of course, we'll appreciate your call so that it's not going to be a monologue for an hour. So this is the time when I want to remind all of our listeners that we're going to be putting on a program here in Santa Cruz on the 29th of November, 2 days after Thanksgiving. We're going to be talking about the church growth movement. We're going to be talking about the Patriot Act. We're going to be talking about the war in Iraq. We're going to be talking about the war against Christianity here and the Ten Commandments. We're going to be talking about Christian persecution, all sorts of exciting programs. We hope you can be there. It's going to be at the Aptos Seascape. You're going to have to make reservations because we're serving lunch. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR to make your reservations. And to our listeners in the Great Northwest, please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our colleagues, and of course, we're going to look forward to your calls this evening here at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. But right now, of course, I thought we would just briefly talk a little bit about what Peter Hammond was saying. And, of course, Peter was talking about how the American government was involved in the fraudulent elections that brought Nelson Mandela to power. Now, contrary to everything you have heard from the media, Nelson Mandela is a lifelong communist, and you've ever seen the pictures of him standing in front of the communist flag with his raised, clenched fist. Who was it who came to his inauguration? Why, Fidel Castro, certainly Gaddafi of Libya, leaders from communist Russia, and of course Hillary Clinton was there as well. Of course, she's always been a Marxist. The average individual, of course, doesn't understand that we have intentionally brought a communist to power in the Rhodesia, we call it Zimbabwe. We have backed the communist government in Southwest Africa. We have backed the communist government. In fact, they're financed by the Chevron Oil Company in Angola and during this long and terrible, terrible war. And what people really don't understand is that the United States government has funded communism since its very inception. And I do hope many of you will want to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, where we, of course, go into the original funding of communism at the very time of the revolution. And quote from Herbert Hoover's memoirs, where he talks about how, of course, there's terrible, terrible famine after the First World War. There's people are starving in Russia. The people don't want a communist government, and of course, but there's no food at all. And so, the America gives massive food and medical supplies, 3% to the anti-communists, 97% to the communists, who have only a very, very small part of the country. And you'll find that in Herbert Hoover's memoirs, and the exact quotation is in my book. We go into the background of how, from the very inception of communism, America's banks and corporations, and even the Federal Reserve representatives, financed communism in Russia. But we can't let the American people know that we were creating the best enemy money could buy, because after all, if we didn't have the enemy, would the American people have been willing to give up their freedom to join the anti-communist organizations, which were funded by the same people who were funding communism? And the thing that changed my life 40 years ago was reading the book Foundations, Their Power and Influence, and realizing that the Rockefeller Foundation and the Ford Foundation and the Carnegie Foundation were funding the communist and socialist activities right here in the United States. And after having read for almost 40 years the World or the other communist publications, we came to the realization that they never attacked the Council on Foreign Relations or the Bilderbergers or the real military-industrial complex. That they always have this sort of, they don't like the Rockefellers, but they never talk about the organizations that are part and parcel of the secret societies that rule America. Why? Because communism has been a creation of these very people. We've got Ron calling from Richland, Washington right now. And again, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. How are you doing, Ron?
Oh, fine, Dr. Stan. I enjoyed your program this evening. Of course, you're not on the air during this hour up in the Northwest.
I wish we were, but of course, it's just a matter of finances. Maybe someday we'll be up there for 2 hours.
Well, we're glad we get what we get. And we really thank Tom Reed for that.
We certainly do, and if it weren't for Tom, we wouldn't be there even for the hour.
Oh, yes. But I enjoyed Dr. Hammond and his talk. It's too bad that he didn't have a chance to go into what happened in Rwanda.
Well, of course, we have that on many of the other four tapes that's with him and the other tape interviews. But I just wanted to go on with what's happening now. But the story of Rwanda, at which he has told on several occasions on our program, is really heartbreaking.
but also the Islamic involvement there. And it, to me, it's almost criminal that we're not doing something about that.
Well, of course, Rwanda is fairly peaceful now. They've had some new elections, and at least Rwanda is not the site of tremendous slaughter today, as is taking place in Nigeria, as is taking place in the Sudan, as is taking place in Angola.
Yes.
But, of course, you know, this is a tragic, tragic story. And, of course, sometime maybe we can get him back on and talk about Rwanda, where, of course, the first thing they did was disarm the people, just like they're trying to do here in America. And then, of course, they came in and they simply hacked the people to death, 800,000 of them, while the United Nations forces were ordered not to intervene and to allow it to happen. And that was Kofi Annan. And, of course, Bill Clinton told members of his cabinet, don't use the word genocide in reference to Rwanda, because then we'd have to come in and do something to stop it. We could have stopped it at any time. You know, in fact, you know, a few hundred well-trained troops could have stopped it. But we allowed it to happen. And I believe that that is the blot on every American who has failed to speak out against that terrible horror, the modern-day Holocaust. 800,000 Rwandans were just hacked to death. And we even have videos that were actually shot there. And the people were pleading for the United Nations troops just to kill them so they wouldn't be hacked to death and have to suffer.
Oh, yes. What about Liberia? It would have been interesting to find out, because we did get involved in that.
Well, we really didn't get that involved. We had a very small number of troops there that went in, and they were only there for a few days. They were a lot of Marines, of course, on a ship offshore. They were only there for a few days. Now that Charles Taylor has left, they do have a new president, and hopefully something will happen. But this has been a terrible area, a terrible slaughter there. And, of course, you have to understand that a lot of this ties into what we talk about, and that is the Rhodes Group. And Cecil Rhodes controls the diamonds, control the diamonds during his time. Today, De Beers, which is Cecil Rhodes' organization, controls the diamonds, and they didn't want any, of course, competition with their diamonds, and so the diamonds, of course, which were being mined there, of course, anybody who was mining diamonds was slaughtered, because you do not compete with De Beers' diamonds anywhere in the world today. If you do, it may cost you your life. So the whole idea of diamonds certainly played a part in what's going on in Liberia, but there's much I don't understand about it, other than this is another example of the horrible things going on in Africa, and we only get little glimpses of it, but we certainly don't see it night after night after night, you know, on television. You know, they want to focus our attention on something, on Toby Bryant, the baseball player, basketball player,
yeah,
night
yeah.
after night after night we hear about it, on O.J. Simpson, night after night after night. But we don't hear about these terrible things happening in Africa or elsewhere in the world, and I wonder why.
You know, I it seems like there's a lot of ethnic strife in Africa, and it's almost like they're trying to foment that here in the United States through, of all things, this affirmative action and racial preference.
Oh, well, of course, I'm sure you're absolutely right. The O.J. Simpson trial was really all about turning black against white in this country. And this was designed, and there's a wonderful book. We have a four-tape set on O.J. Simpson. Nobody wants that four-tape set. It's one of the best ones we ever put together. One is an interview with a man who wrote a book who was notified by a member of the HIP team, or at least a man who claimed he was part of the HIP team that killed Nicole. And, of course, they were employed to set up this whole scheme to create a race war in America. And I will tell you that almost every black man believes O.J. Simpson was framed. And I believe he was framed, too. I don't know whether he was guilty or innocent, but if he was innocent, they framed a guilty man. But, you know, of course, almost every white believes, of course, that O.J. Simpson was guilty. And I believe that they knew exactly what they were doing as they staged that trial. And I think that's the part of why they're playing this Toby Bryant story up so heavily, because they really want a racial discord in this country. And then they want, of course, to turn the Hispanic against the white and the white against the Hispanic. And this is how you divide and conquer. And, of course, the white against the Muslim and the Muslim against the white. That's why they brought them into the country in such large numbers, where they repealed the McCarran Immigration Act back, of course, in the 1965. While our attention was focused on Vietnam, they changed their immigration laws because they wanted to create a multicultural society, and they didn't want a common language. Every effort to have English, the official language of this country, was effectively blocked by the people who want discord in America to tear us apart.
Yeah, it almost seems like that.
It is. Well, we've got John Leffler on the line.
Okay, well, I'll sign off. Thanks.
Hey,
thanks,
Ron, thanks so much for calling in to help me out.
Okay, God bless.
Bye-bye. Okay, fine. Well, we've got the famous John Leffler. Thank you so much for coming on, John.
Hi there. I was driving home from my martial arts class, and I heard the interview with Dr. Hammond, and that's always an enlightening one. And then heard you say you weren't going to have any guests because obviously he bombed out on the second hour, and I've been where you are before.
John, God love you for being willing to come on with me. For our listeners who don't know John, he does his own radio program. He's certainly one of the best-known conservative talk show hosts in the country, and we're fortunate to be able to have him here for the second hour. Thank you so much for being with us.
I don't think you want to identify me as conservative anymore. That just doesn't have meaning, does it? We need to come up with a new name for ourselves, you know, constitutionalist or something.
All right. I won't disagree with you at all, because I certainly don't want to conserve what we have today, that's for sure.
That's what I'm thinking. Yeah.
I don't want to be associated with the current regime we have there in Washington, D.C., that claims it's conservative and yet is the biggest spender, is going to give us the biggest deficits in our nation's history, and I'm firmly convinced that short of some miraculous divine intervention, they're going to bankrupt America, both morally and economically.
Yeah, it seems that we're headed that way. You know, things you were starting to talk about really struck me. We just got done doing the Financial Sense News Hour about 3 hours ago, and things came up on the show. You know, Russia is now going to is seriously considering basing its ruble on 10% on gold, which would make it a much more stable currency. And this all comes in the same week that Vladimir Putin said they're going to begin bidding oil prices out of Russia in euros, etc. And Bush right now is over talking to the Chinese and the Japanese and asking them not to put pressure on our currency markets over here. The bottom line on the whole thing is the dollar is going to be coming under excruciating pressure in the very near future. I think it was Sir John Templeton just said the dollar was going to fall by 40% of its value in the next 6 months. And you realize that we have over $1 trillion to $1.5 trillion is overseas in foreign hands. And everybody's getting nervous and jittery out there. Because what has to happen is, as soon as it looks like the jig is up, they've somehow got to get their dollars back in here before they become worthless. That would mean a big flood of dollars coming back to our shore. Literally overnight, we could see our money supply almost double.
Well, but John, I really believe that this new colored currency that they're turning out now, I think that they know exactly what's going to happen. I think that they know exactly what you're saying is absolutely true. And I believe that, of course, one of these days they're going to say, sorry, if you don't have a colored $20 bill, you might as well burn it because it's absolutely no good. And when that happens, you're going to see panic throughout the world. And, of course, people will never again want to be holding American dollars. But that will, of course, come with the demise of the dollar. And everything you were saying, for our listeners, John does a program with Jim Poplava, who's a well-known a financier and advisor on financial matters. And certainly that quotation from John Templeton was echoed by Richard Russell, who said within this last week, that, you know, the dollar has already fallen 30%. He is anticipating it'll fall another 30 to 40%. That means that
right.
The dollar you hold today will soon be worth 30 cents. In fact, we won't even be as well off as they are down in Argentina. Their peso is worth 33 cents. It used to be worth a dollar. And what that did was result in the impoverishment of half the population, in Argentina today lives in poverty. People say that could never happen here, but we are intent upon shipping our industries overseas, our white-collar jobs overseas, and I've come to the conclusion that one reason for the war in Iraq is to distract our attention from the fact that they are destroying our economy here at home through debt and through a planned program of exporting our jobs, exporting our future and our children's future.
Well, I think that's where we're headed. It's amazing. And Templeton was saying in the next 6 months, I mean, he's calling for an immediate devaluation, which means if you're smart, you'll go out and buy, I think the currencies it's going to stand up against it, believe it or not, are the Canadian dollar, the Australian dollar, the New Zealand dollar, and I don't know how the euro is going to do against
it. How about
the
Swiss franc?
That's a good question. We didn't talk about that today. That's a real good, when we were discussing it, he was discussing it with one of his technical people that we have on the show, and I wasn't involved directly in the conversation. I was thinking that. I never got a chance to ask that before the end of the show.
But, of course, you know, none of these are really backed by gold. They're all certainly backed by the integrity of their political leaders. And when could you ever find a political leader who wouldn't try to inflate his way out of a problem?
Sure. I mean, there it is. The funny part is I've been reading a lot of the liberal sites lately because to a large degree they understand that the neocons were a con job. But funny thing is they don't it's sort of like getting the right, remember when in school when you used to do this, you got the right answer but you got it the wrong way?
Right.
And I'm noticing it's like, I saw columns today, why is this big war in Iraq that's creating all this deficit? Well, I mean, that's just a crying heart story, because if there were no war in Iraq, they'd be spending it on all these social programs. And under Democratic Congresses, we ran up $5 trillion worth of debt over 30 years. So I don't have a lot of sympathy for that. And really, because people don't understand what the real core issues are, that's why we never get the problem solved, is the issues as they're debated on Hannity and Combs and places like that. I can only throw so much at the television screen before it's dirty and I have to clean it, you know, because I just can't stand nonsense. And if you watch these talking financial hairdos on there, it's just unbelievable the garbage they pour out. The everything coming out of the screen is designed to achieve a reaction on the part of the public rather than to inform the public about what's really happening. Right now we have this whole thing in semiconductor stocks again. I don't know if you've been watching that.
No, I really don't. Tell me about it.
The stocks are bidding up. They're like, they've gone up 61% in value since the beginning of the year. It's the same kind of frenzy we had in the 90s with all the dot-com revolutions. And yet the value of the companies in Silicon Valley, all the value indicators are going down. So there's no correlation between the value of the stock, the real value of the companies, and what they're doing. And what's going on? It's absolutely insane.
Well, I was just reading my McIlvenny report. He was commenting that the Standard & Poor's price-earnings ratio is about 30 to 33 to 1. Now, it should be about between 10 to 1 and 8 to 1. But the price-earnings ratio on the .com and NASDAQ stocks is 200 to 1.
Right.
That's almost as bad as it was just before we had the bubble before. Do you think what they're doing is sucking the suckers back into the stock market? They want to get in quickly before it drops out again?
Well, that's sort of what's happening, and whether or not that's the plan. Remember, in order for them to make money, there always has to be a pool of suckers for the stock market to work the way it's been done. And most of the people out there will chase the meter, so to speak, which is what drives Jim crazy, because his clientele base, of course, operates. He picks what he believes to be trends over a period of time, and he gets a very good return for his clients, somewhere in the 20 to 30% range per annum. But the worst thing he can deal with is when these clients get nervous because everybody else is, you know, they're out on the golf course or at the country club or at church, and, hey, we're chasing these stocks. And so they'll call him up, why aren't you chasing the stocks and doing all this? And because he said they're not worth anything. They're dangerous, you know. So that's the kind of mentality you have. The biggest bottom line, you know, we talk about education a lot on the program, and the biggest bottom line to date is the fact that due to the educational system, Americans have lost the ability to think critically. And that's why we're in trouble.
Well, I certainly agree with you. One of the interesting statistics I read was the fact that the executives on many of these large corporations are selling their stock. Though ordinarily, of course, they would be accumulating stock if they thought that things were good. In the past, of course, a couple of years ago, there was something like $30 in stock shares being sold for everyone being bought. In other words, the people who run these major corporations aren't very optimistic. They're selling their shares. This latest statistic, I think it was $44 or $48 in shares being sold for every $1 being bought by the CEOs of major corporations. What would that suggest to you, that they know that the suckers are going into the stock market now don't know?
Yeah, exactly. And not only that, all the problems with Enron have not been solved. There's only been a slight amount of hand slapping. None of the mechanisms that allowed this stuff to come about has been fixed. The companies, if you notice, continue to report pro forma earnings rather than hard earnings, and the pro forma then are designed to achieve a certain outcome. Not only that, all you hear about, they say, well, the Acme Corporation just beat estimates. Well, who cares? So what they do is they keep moving the bar up and down. So the figures that you get out of the corporations now, if you don't get their 10-Q reports, the figures that you're seeing there are absolutely worthless. Absolutely worthless for telling what's going on with these companies. And what really tells you is the level of indebtedness the companies have, what they really post in terms of their income and losses, aside from all this pro forma reporting, how many people they're laying off. I don't know. I wasn't until after tonight's show. And we've known it for some time, but every once in a while something really hits you. And I realize we're coming home to just a horrible shipwreck. I think Jim calls them train wrecks, because all of these trends are converging. And you know what's funny is the terrorists know that. They know that we are paper strong now. I was watching an interview a couple of weeks ago on Univision in Spanish. They had an exclusive interview that they did with President Vicente Fox of Mexico. And they asked him about the illegal immigrant situation here in the U.S. and what he thought about it, etc. And I was flabbergasted to hear him say, I was recording it, and I actually ran the tape back a couple of times to make sure I understood what he said. And he said the amount of money being sent back home to Mexico by people working illegally in the U.S., the revenue exceeds the revenue Mexico received from oil receipts, from Pemex, okay? And I was just astounded at that. And what people don't understand when we talk about this type of offshoring, we know it's going on everywhere, that money leaves the country. It doesn't come back. The jobs that are going offshore, Dr. Stan, they will not be back in any way, shape, or form. Remember when we went through NAFTA and GATT? That was in 1995. I remember you and I were in the thick of that whole little fight back there 7 years ago. And if you remember, what we were told at the time was we had to do this to stay competitive in the global economy. That was the first rationalization. And the second thing was we didn't need manufacturing jobs anymore because of the fact that we were now going to be a service sector. We were the world's service sector supplier. Okay. Well, guess what? All of those jobs are going offshore. One of the most blatant of these is I was talking to a woman today who had gone in for an MRI, either an MRI or something else.
A CT scan, right?
Yeah, major diagnostic. They digitized it and they shipped it off to, I believe it was Pakistan or India.
Right. Yeah, and they're reading them over there. Why should they pay us a radiologist $150,000 a year here when they can ship that over there? And for $30,000 a year, they can get them all read over there. And that's exactly what they're doing with the support for our Dell computer. That's of course being we get that support over in Pakistan. You call in for your Dell computer and you talk to a fellow named Joe, and he's the nicest guy you ever come to meet. Perfect English, but he lives in Pakistan. And of course, we called in this last week for our Hewlett-Packard printer, and of course, we talked to a fellow named Pete, and he lived in New Delhi. And,
that's not his real name either.
No, no, I know it. But, it probably was a Satish or something like that, but they changed their names because they really don't want the American people to realize that our major corporations are shipping all their jobs overseas, and they don't want the American people to realize what's going on until suddenly people are living in poverty, there are riots and demonstrations in the streets, and people are going to say, what happened? Why was those Republicans, they, of course, shipped our heritage overseas, but it wasn't the Republicans. This is a matter of bipartisan treason, in my estimation.
That's really the hard part to get everybody to understand. This is the product of Socialist Party D and Socialist Party R. And when we talk about, for example, the Democrats would like to blame, you know how the political palaver goes.
Oh, sure.
They would like to blame, we're spending all this money in Iraq and people are hurting back here. Well, that's nice, but all of the social spending back here isn't going to stop the hurt. Our problem is a sick economy. The other thing they haven't reckoned with, people are bailing out of the income tax system in record numbers. That's why, in one of these cases, this FedEx pilot a month or two ago that won the case against the IRS because she said I couldn't find a law that required me to file, she won that case. And, of course, then they came out with an announcement about 2 weeks later that the IRS was working with state tax agencies to chase down these tax avoiders. That's not stopping them. They are bailing out in droves. And the one thing that I just finally just become incensed with is I keep hearing we need to raise taxes. In other words, I'm looking at some of these Democratic candidates. If they get back in, I keep thinking, well, basically what you're telling me is I'm dying from arsenic poisoning, so to cure me from that, you're going to give me a shot of cyanide, okay? And the worst thing you can do, if you remember what really threw us into the Great Depression. We had the Wall Street crash in October of 29. It went through the normal recovery cycle. Now, the Hoover administration at that time jumped in, and that was a Republican administration, and began jerking and tugging on every single lever. They penetrated to levels of the economy you wouldn't have believed. And then they raised the income tax. Here goes that myth again. Let's raise the income tax. That will get us out of the depression or whatever. Well, the economy was recovering already by 1931. And it just rolled over, groaned, and went down for the next 15 years from the income tax rates. And I don't understand this. This is absolute insanity. And that's why I'm saying it wasn't until tonight after we got done with the show and then a couple of things Dr. Hammond said triggered some thoughts. And I suddenly realized we are headed to a train wreck of just incredible proportions.
But of course, John, did you ever stop and think that maybe they're doing it intentionally, that these people are not stupid, they know what they're doing? I mean, certainly many of the politicians, have the knee-jerk, tax the rich bit of idea, but there are people there who are intentionally running up massive debts and massive deficits, and of course, the end result would be the destruction of the America we know and the impoverishment of our people, and of course that, and then perhaps a coming war, will of course end America as we've known it for.
Well, did I lose you, Dr. Stan?
No, I'm
sorry. I apologize. It sounded like I lost you there for just a sec. No, I really agree with that, and that's what I, ironically, part way through training tonight, we just all stopped, and Andrew, who's our instructor, began talking about this, the same train wreck we're talking about, which is what started me to think about it. And I tend to think, remember Hitler used to call it Gleichschaltung. The only way to bring that word across is equalization is the best way I can think about it. But basically when we put NAFTA and GATT together, the goal is to create world units, in other words, regional economic units. We are slated to become one economic unit with Canada and Mexico. Now what that does is it ratchets our standard of life down. At the same time, it brings the Mexican standard of life, for example, up.
But don't you think we're going to include Central and South, at least all of Central America?
I think Central America as well. It'll be North America is what it will be, and that includes Central America, right. And I agree, it's deliberate, because if you go back and start digging through the records, you find this stuff there. That these people were talking about this. You got a break coming up.
I do, and of course our guest this evening is John Loeffler. If you're out there in the listening audience and you have a question or comment, don't hesitate to give us a call. But of course, let's have it on the subject, because we're talking about the coming financial catastrophe that we face, and nobody wants to talk about it. but it's very real. Greatest deficits in all of history are looming ahead of us. With next year, $750 billion deficit, took us almost 200 years to create the first $1 trillion deficit. And George Bush is going to be able to accomplish that simply in a period of 12 months. Isn't that a great accomplishment? Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and of course this is the time when I have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and if you're out there listening to us and you agree that there's a problem and you feel that this sort of information should be known to every American, if you'd like to become part of our team, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WARREN. We have almost 60 outlets across America now. A lot of them are just half an hour a week, but at least half an hour a week, people are hearing the truth that they never heard before. So if you'd like to become part of our team, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927 and give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. Then, of course, if you'd like a free copy of our newsletter, we'd be more than happy to send you one. And, of course, the newsletter, our September newsletter, tells you what really happened on the morning of September 11, 2001. It's the testimony of Mindy Kleinberg, who lost her husband in the North Tower. And, of course, what happened that morning? Well, of course, you've been told by the media what happened, but there are still a lot of very serious questions. And the testimony was given before the investigating committee looking to 9/11 in March of this year. And the most amazing thing, it was blacked out by the entire media. Could you believe that? Well, maybe they were more interested in Toby Bryant, or I don't suppose he was around at that time. They can always find something to distract our attention away from really important or significant things, and that's how, of course, are they able to control so effectively what the American people think. But if you'd like a free copy of our September newsletter, just give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And then, of course, we want to mention that we're having a day-long seminar here on the 29th of November, 2 days after Thanksgiving. And we're going to, of course, bring in Dr. Robert Klink, and he's going to be talking about the church growth movement. And it sounds so wonderful. This is really, oh my goodness, we're going to unite the Christians in America, and we're going to create a great Christian revival, and we're going to take America back. At least that's what we're telling people with the purpose-driven church. But, of course, what's the real agenda behind this? Well, I think you'll be fascinated to hear Dr. Klink. We're going to have, of course, talks on the Patriot Act. We're going to have talks on why we're in Iraq, on Christian persecution, on health issues. And we hope that you'll want to come. It's going to be held at the Aptos Seascape from 8:30 in the morning until 5 or 5:30 in the evening. A lunch will be served. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. We hope you'll be there for the all-day conference, that you'll bring your friends, we can get a great turnout, and I promise you it'll be a program you won't forget. That's November 29th. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and first our special guest this evening is John Loeffler, who was good enough to call in when he found out we weren't going to have Peter Hammond for the second hour. And, of course, we're talking about what's happening to our economy. And John Templeton, certainly Sir John, is one of the smartest people in the country. He said, well, don't buy a house now. Wait till they get down to about a tenth of what they are, and then you can go ahead and buy a house. But don't buy a house now. And yet, of course, people are rushing out and buying houses. And soon, I suspect that the loans on those houses will be worth far more than the house itself is worth. And we'll see happening here exactly what happened over in Japan, where the banks have all these houses with very, very little value in property in the same way. And, of course, the American people are being pushed into indebtedness. I get something on the Internet today offering me loans at a 3% APR. That doesn't tell me what that is, but I can borrow on my house at 3% APR. What a wonderful deal, except, of course, they can change the rate at any time without notice. And more people are getting heavier and heavier in debt because, of course, the only way they can keep the economy going is for people to continue spending and spending and spending. But when more and more people are out of work, and more people do not have any margin left on their credit cards, or they're going to have to actually pay those credit cards back. Then what happens? There are going to be more bankruptcies this year than I understand at any previous time. Have you heard that sort of thing, John?
I've heard about the bankruptcy, but you're right about the credit. And what a lot of people have been doing is using their houses as piggy banks. And they've been going in, because the houses have been appreciating in value due to this frenzy of refinancing, people are refining the houses, and they're running the loan balances up to the hill, and then they're using that money for other things, either lifestyle or... And to be honest, a lot of little guys are just keeping going on plastic right now. People have been out of work or whatever. It's not just people living a expensive lifestyle. But we're now at a point right now where, I said, people bailing out of the tax system. Little people can't keep going. You know, we keep hearing about compassionate government, and nothing infuriates me more than this whole argument about tax cuts for the rich. It's total balderdash, because you're rich now, basically, if you make anything more than about $28,000 a year as far as the tax. And more people now, Dr. Stan, are getting bitten by the alternative minimum tax. Remember, they put that one in because to try to, you know, rich people would factor in all these deductions and whatever, and even if they had deducted their income tax to zero, they said, oh, but you still owe tax, that type of thing. Well, that was great when people were higher up there, but now they're finding people who are starting to make money, and even if they're able to whittle the tax down, they have to pay the alternative minimum tax. That's why it's going to be, see, what I'm seeing here is on the international scene, China's the strongest growing economy out there. It's becoming a large military force, and look what they just did in the space thing this week. When this crunch starts coming over oil, or when Russia begins taking the prices in euro, you know, when we get to this stage in history, Dr. Stan, this is when wars start, because countries have to do it to either fix their problems or to distract people from their problems. That's the first thing. The second thing is, in here in this country, I wish I could see better. I mean, I'm not pessimistic about us individually, because God always takes care of us. I'm just analyzing what I see going on. And I don't see any way out of this thing. I keep working this in my head, saying, what could the way? Could they confiscate enough gold or stuff? No, that won't work. And when you do start confiscating gold, you're sort of admitting that the whole thing's bust, because they're working so hard to keep the price of gold down now. So what way are we getting off of this thing? I had suspected, Jim and I discussed a nationalization of housing properties. In other words, for people who are in that situation that you just described, where the mortgage balance or the value of the house will plummet right down to the mortgage balance, what they will probably do, I said, well, what about nationalizing the houses? And he sort of agreed that was a possibility. What will happen is the federal government will come in. It'll be called the Federal Government Private Property Rescue Agency or something like that. They will take title to your property, and you can rent from them now. In other words, that's how they'll do it, until you can equalize out the situation. I said, that's one real serious possibility. And if you notice what's happening is, all around, the bottom line is we're losing our freedom. We have been sold a bill of goods. We've been sold down the tubes. And we're losing our freedom economically and in every other way. We're supposed to have womb-to-tomb education, monitoring of who we are, everything we do, what we buy, what we eat, what we read, so that we can comply. Barrett Chose and I, in my next show next week, we'll be talking about the new international standards for mental health. And if you're a Christian, you don't match the new standards for mental health, because your belief system is not mentally healthy. So that's what we're facing. And you and I see this because we follow it. You won't find that out from Dan Rather. The only thing you'll find out from Dan Rather is that homeschooling is a very bad idea.
Well, of course, I tell people, yeah, these are the things you're not going to hear from Rush Limbaugh, Bill O'Reilly, or Dan Rather. Because, of course, they are already, of course, part and parcel of this same amount of deception. And yet, of course, so many people honestly believe Bill O'Reilly is a conservative and Rush Limbaugh is a conservative and Dan Rather is liberal. And I say that they're two sides of the same coin. But, of course, it's a dross coin. It's a valueless coin. Well, you know, as we look and see what's going on today, the average individual is sort of puzzled as to how this whole thing is going to fit together. But, you know, I think that you have to understand that when a country turns its back on God, God eventually withdraws his protection from that nation. And so we can look at what's going on from an economic point of view, and none of it makes sense. Why would any country, or why would the leaders of both political parties have gone along with NAFTA and the World Trade Organization, realizing full well that it was going to involve the redistribution of the wealth of our people? And I believe this is a long-range plan. I can remember back in 1982, there was a meeting at Cancun and there in Mexico, and of course the financial leaders of the world were meeting, and Ronald Reagan was there, but the leaders of the Socialist International were there as well, and of course they held meetings, and they published in their magazine Socialist Affairs, and they said, why should the people of America have so much money and the rest of the people in the world be so poor? What we should do is redistribute the wealth of the American people. And I can remember reading that and chuckling to myself and saying, these fellows are so stupid that they think the American people would ever go along with that. And then I see what's going on today, and I say, those people were so smart because the American people are so stupid that we are allowing them to redistribute our wealth and our children's wealth. And, of course, we are going to be impoverished here in this country. We are going to see riots in this country, just as the IMF and World Bank policies are created throughout the rest of the world, and the countries is systematically, through the process of financial imperialism, why we've impoverished the people of the rest of the world. And I believe that whatever goes around comes around. Men and women become accomplices to the evils they fail to oppose. And, of course, when, of course, you bring this catastrophe to the people of the rest of the world and you're unconcerned, eventually, of course, the same things will come right here to the United States. And I believe that's why FEMA is, of course, setting up detention camps throughout the country in the name of course, Homeland Security, right.
Yeah.
I think that this all is planned. They know exactly what's going to happen. They just don't want the American people to realize until they have become impoverished.
There is a day. I wrote this in one of my recent editorials on News with Views. There is a day coming when the Christian community will curse the name of John Ashcroft, because not only will the laws being set in place right now be used against instability, as the new move towards enforce the new global health standards and the new conformity standards of what is politically correct and incorrect begins to work against people of faith, there is coming a day when they will curse his name. I actually predict that confidently.
Well, I don't know why John Ashcroft is doing what he's doing, but I read about 6 newspapers every day, and every once in a while you find a true article there, and I came across one, I've even forgotten which newspaper it is, but I have it, and basically, of course, you've heard this, how John Ashcroft has gone across the country condemning those who oppose the Patriot Act and how we have to have that to maintain our freedom, and why, of course, this is the reason we're not having any terrorist attacks, and these people who believe that they are going to the librarians and, of course, getting information on the books people read, why, of course, that isn't true. And John Ashcroft has actually declassified the information, and he wants to assure us that the Justice Department has never used that provision in the law. So why is all this hysteria out here? Obviously, these people must believe in black helicopters, and they're really extremists because they believe that this law is being used. Well, I came across this article that said the law had been used somewhere around 50 times. The Library Association had polled, 80 librarians, and 16 of them had actually received subpoenas asking for records on, of course, various people coming to the libraries of what books they were reading. But, of course, it would be a federal crime for any of those librarians to admit publicly they'd ever been subpoenaed. Now, why would they want to put librarians in jail for admitting they'd been subpoenaed? What are they concealing from the American people? Is it John Ashcroft doesn't really know what's going on? Or does he know, and, well, is he not telling us the truth? Could that be the case?
It doesn't make any difference because the outcome is still the same. In other words, I never try to judge the person's motives or stuff. I'm just saying the outcome is still the same. And it all floats on shifting definitions of what's an enemy combatant, what's a terrorist, what in the interest of national security. Those are all floating definitions. The danger is that they put the precedent in place to start with.
Well, I think that you're absolutely right. And I think that the American people have to see that the Patriot Bill, we are told, was, of course, enacted to control Islamic terrorism. There's not one word in that entire legislation about Islamic terrorism. Now, wait a minute, I thought this was about Islamic terrorism. No, it's not about Islamic terrorism. They've simply changed the definition of terrorism. And, of course, the Office of Homeland Security is not to make us safer. It's to be able to monitor law-abiding American citizens, to actually federalize our police force, and to set up the makings of a federal Gestapo. Why would a Republican administration do something like that? Because it was already planned long before the September 11th attack. And those of you who haven't seen the Phase 3 report from the National Commission on Security in the 21st Century that was authorized in 97, held its first meeting in 98, put its first report out in September of the year 1999, and we actually have copies of that, where they talk about the terrorist attacks that are coming on America. 14 commissioners on the National Commission. Gee, it's only coincidence that 13 of them came from the Council on Foreign Relations. Isn't that a strange coincidence?
Boy, I wonder what the random chances of that happening by accident are.
And, of course, their 2000 report was the Office of Homeland Security. That's Phase 3. We have all of these things. Anybody wants to get them from Radio Liberty, of course, we can't give those away because that's about an inch and a half or 2 inches thick. But we have these reports. You can pull them down off the Internet, or you can get them from Radio Liberty. You have to know that everything that is happening was scripted long before September 11th. In my estimation, even September 11th was scripted long before September 11th.
Yeah, all they were looking for was a catalyst. September 11th was one of those fortunate opportunities, so to speak. And you know, we can go into all the issues of prior knowledge, but the bottom line on it is that it was an excuse. And the liberals are right. I mean, they are right. There isn't any connection between Iraq and the other. And what happened on 9/11. It was what I call the bomb and switch routine. It was Osama bin Laden, pop, Saddam Hussein. First time I heard it, I went, whoa, how did we get there? You know, what's the linkage?
Well, of course, have you interviewed Paul Sperry yet and his book, Crude Politics?
Yes.
Isn't that great? I mean, here, for our listeners who hasn't read this book, you have to read it because he talks about the special forces that were sent into Afghanistan to get Osama bin Laden. When they got there, they were told, you can't go after Osama bin Laden. Oh, no, we're going to have you do this and that and the other thing, but you can't go after Osama bin Laden. We're going to let the Afghans who love Osama, of course, capture him for us. And you'd never guess what happened. They escorted him across over into Pakistan. We didn't go into Afghanistan to get Osama bin Laden. We went into Afghanistan to crush the Taliban so we could build a pipeline there, because if we were trying to get Osama bin Laden, we did the most incredibly poor job. And then, of course, Richard Miniter's book, Losing Bin Laden, on 12 separate occasions prior to September 11th, we could have taken Osama bin Laden out. Even the Sudanese government wanted to give him to us in 1996 after he had already arranged for killing our boys in Somalia and bombing the hotels where our boys were in Aden in 1992. And, of course, the bombing in Riyadh in 1995 where they killed Americans. And in 1996, when the government of Sudan was pleading to give us all their records on al-Qaeda and give us Osama bin Laden, we wouldn't take him. I wonder why.
Is this a trick question?
No. It's a rhetorical question. But, I mean, when you see these, and we certainly carry the book of Crude Politics, we think is a very, very important book. We think Richard Miniter's book is very important as well. Losing bin Laden, you must understand that the battle is not against Osama bin Laden. We could have taken him out at any time. The battle is against the American people and freedom.
You know, it's funny you mention that. I started out, the second place I got a job when I started into broadcasting in the 60s was at KCBS, not very far from where you are, in San Francisco. You know, I was an assistant news editor, producer there. And that was a good training ground for me. But I began to notice one thing when I was there. I began to notice that there was always a big gap between what the politician said, promised, and what actually happened. The words didn't seem to match the results or the actions. You would always go to yourself, if you think to yourself, well, how did we get over there? That just didn't make any sense because they were talking over here. And you're right about one thing. In other words, after a while, I learned to stop listening to what they were saying in terms of anything representing reality and to begin looking at the patterns. And that's very hard to get Americans to do, is to get them beyond looking at the individual dots and looking at the overall movement of the dots. So the movement of the dots tells you where we're going to wind up. And that's what, when you paint this picture today, you start to slide away from the conclusion that this is all random chance in politics, and there seems to be a pattern here. And the pattern is, the, as I called it earlier, the Gleichschaltung of the country, the dumbing down of the people so they can't think and they don't have the mental skills to deal with what's going on, the destruction of the economy, allowing it to, so that we can equalize. And that was even the discussion, if you remember, back at the Earth Summit in Rio back in 1992, was that the U.S. was too prosperous. They had to ratchet down the U.S. economy to the level of a third world country. At the same time, we would distribute the wealth of America to other countries, to some of those third world countries, so that we could bring them up a bit. And they never quite managed to identify exactly how you were going to destroy the U.S. economy and at the same time distribute the wealth that it produces. But that's what we see happening right now before us. And you're right. The average Joe on the street cannot for the life of him figure out what's going on. But look at the tube at the night. What do you learn on the television at night that will tell you anything of what is happening or going on or showing you these patterns? You don't. They're part of the... I get so frustrated.
Well, you know,
one of them thinks to ask what pro forma means when you look at results and stuff. Who cares about pro forma numbers?
Well, you know, so interesting. We did a program the other morning with Dr. Michael Kaufman on a book called Globalism and Its Detractors or Defectors or something of the sort by an award-winning Nobel Prize-winning economist who had been the chief of the Council of Economic Advisors under Clinton, then the chief economic advisor to the World Bank. And in that book, of course, the economist was talking about the policies of the IMF, and, of course, I suspect of the World Bank as well, although he didn't say it at the time because he was working for the World Bank, and how they would go into the countries, they would, throughout the world, they would demand privatization. And when they, of course, demanded privatization, what would happen, they would bribe the people who were in charge of the countries, and then, of course, major corporations, international corporations, would come in and buy up the natural resources, the utilities, things like that, raise the prices, impoverish the people, and then, of course, with the various policies it would carry out, eventually it would lead to the total disruption of the economy of the country, the impoverishment of the people, and then the riots. He used to call them the IMF riots because they knew they were going to follow. And what was really so interesting about, after we did the program and we talked about this idea of financial imperialism being, of course, mediated by the IMF and the World Bank, we got over 30 responses that morning to that program out of our Colorado station, which never happens. But people could hear, they could realize what we were saying was true. And if you tell the people the truth on programs like yours or mine, at least the people who've listened enough can begin to see what's happening, and hopefully at least a few people are becoming informed so that they will be able to make the preparations to protect themselves as best they can for the coming economic storm.
Yeah, and that's sort of the thing. You know, you're right. You hit it right on the head, Dr. Stan. I have this. First of all, I have a very low threshold for tolerating nonsense, or BS, as I call it. But the second thing is I really care about the little guy, okay, and the people out there. And I have this passion for truth. It's like, tell me what's going on here. What's really is? And that's why we do it. And you, as well as I know, you have to filter through. There's a lot of rabbit trails. There's a lot of error. There's a lot of crazy conspiracy theories out there that just don't pan out. There's a lot of anti-conspiracy theories that don't pan out. And you always have to ask yourself, what's true? Not is it strange, not is it in the public mind, not is it the common thing. But, you know, if you look back at our track record, 10 years ago we did a video in Denver with Barrett Chose and Charlotte Israbeat that I produced and two other participants, and those people, three ladies and a gentleman, laid out the whole plan for U.S. education. and where we would be a decade from then, and here we are now. And everything they said on that video was correct. Now, at the time, public school teachers were saying, oh, no, these people are very badly misinformed. They just don't understand what they mean, blah, blah, blah. You know, the first time that we talked about, I went back through my archives. You know, the first time we ever mentioned Osama bin Laden on my radio show was in August of 1996, Dr. Stan. So I think you and I and a few of us that work real hard at this have been cutting edge. We're not prophets. We just simply sit down and examine what is going on, and the best place to go is right to the horse's mouth. You know, when you talk to Jim Garrison at the Gorbachev Foundation, and he says, we need chaos, because chaos is going to get us to move in the direction, and a lot of people are going to be hurt. All right, well, that means they know there's chaos coming. When they say, we have to ratchet down the U.S. economy, and we're going to do this through international treaties and things like that, and you have no trouble finding this in the articles and speeches, then I take them at their word. That's what they've said they're going to do. You know, if everybody had read Mein Kampf in 1923, they would have known what Hitler was going to do to the Jews in 1943. But all the way through the 30s, Hitler came to power right in 32, 33. And the Wannsee Conference wasn't held until 41, 42. I don't have it right in front of me here. I should know it. I'm ashamed of myself. Anyway, a decade later. And all through the decade, people were trying to figure out what was going on. In other words, right in the middle of it, they couldn't see it. And the Jewish community was in a state of constant denial. He wouldn't do that. The Fuhrer, you know, he wouldn't do that. If we just hunker down, it's bad times, but maybe it'll blow over, that type of thing. And even the Gentile populations were doing that. But it all played itself out. And that's the way we're going. And like you, people need to understand what's coming, not so they can panic, but so that they have a perspective in making the decisions of their lives. Because indeed, the truth does make you free. You know, one of the greatest lies of history, and this is reflected in the scripture, was contained over the entrance to Auschwitz concentration camp. Arbeit macht frei. Work shall make you free. Nothing could be further than the truth. Jesus said, the truth shall make you free. All right? Not works of the law, but truth will set you free. And that's why, and people will email me, will doctor to say, John, what do I do, blah, blah, blah. I don't know what you do. Everybody's circumstances are different. I'm just trying to get you to understand what's happening so in your circumstance, the person listening, you can figure out wise courses of action to shelter you and your family from the storm that's coming. If there weren't any storm, you know, I could be making a six-digit figure doing something else in broadcasting. Okay? I could be doing happy radio right now on a big market station every day, doing a funny drive-time talk show, talking about all sorts of irrelevant issues. I could be doing that. But my conscience wouldn't be clear.
Well, I'm sure glad that you're up there that doing what I'm doing, because I always want, when I get down, I want to always be able to call John Leffler and have him cheer me up. There's always some wonderful stories. John, thank you so much for being with us this evening. What are your parting thoughts for our listeners?
You know what? The world has been through turmoil like this before. It is not unknown to God. In the end, God wipes it all away. You know, when J. Paul Getty died, you know how much money he left behind, Dr. Stan? He left all of it.
Right.
Okay? We come into the world with nothing. We leave with nothing except our good works that follow us. And God will take care of everybody who believes in him through the roughest of times. And he sends people to warn ahead of time, not to frighten, but just to say, look, I've been here before you. I know what you're going to go through. I'm here with you.
And of course, that, of course, is our hope. God bless you. Thank you so much, John.
God bless. Say hi to Barbara.
Bye-bye. Well, I think what John has said is true. We're going to have to put our faith in the Lord. We're in for some very, very difficult times. If you don't have a personal relationship with the Lord and you'd like to talk about it, give me a call. I'm not a minister. I'm an orthopedic surgeon. But believe me, I've been around long enough to know that God does rule in the affairs of men. And so until tomorrow at the same time, when we'll be back with you once again, or I guess it'll be Monday now, won't it? This is Dr. Stan saying, pray for America and pray for Radio Liberty for our provision and protection. Good night. May the Lord be with you.